I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. More and more, we are asked for our feedback about our shopping experiences, the service at a restaurant, our stay at a hotel. We're asked to rate our professors, comment on the quality of a particular product, and fill out customer satisfaction surveys. We've gotten pretty comfortable dishing out our negative opinions about people and products, especially if it's done anonymously. And it's so easy to pile on when there's a particularly incendiary tweet or when someone is behaving badly in public. But giving and receiving criticism in person, whether at home or at work, is a different story. It's so easy to get defensive and hostile when you're on the receiving end and to misfire when you're the person delivering the negative feedback. And for many of us, there's the most negative and meanest critic of all, and that's the one in our head. Today on The Connection, how to give and take criticism so it benefits everyone. And let me introduce our guests. Andrea Bonnier is a clinical psychologist, professor at Georgetown University, author of a book titled Detox Your Thoughts, Quit Negative Self-Talk for Good, and Discover the Life You've Always Wanted. Andrea Bonnier, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us, Christine Porath. She's a professor of organizational behavior at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, author of a book titled Mastering Community, The Surprising Ways Coming Together Move Us from Surviving to Thriving. And Christine Porath, nice to have you with us on The Connection as well.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Andrea, let me begin with you. And although, Christine, I'd like to hear from you as well. We know that we're not perfect. We know that we make mistakes. We know that we're going to fall short. We know that we're going to do things that we are going to regret. Why is it so tough to hear and get criticism? Why are we so sensitive about negative feedback? And Andrea, I'll start with you.
Sure. You know, it's really interesting. I think it even goes back to evolution, honestly, because the idea of criticism or negative feedback is actually really tied to that fear of rejection. You know, if people don't like something I did, they might eventually push me away or they might kick me out of the tribe. And when we really think about our need to belong, it is baked into us. It's who we are. So I think a lot of times rejection activates that fear that we will be isolated, that we will be shunted aside. And that really, if we look at brain research, interestingly enough, it can feel like physical pain. It lights up in the same ways that, you know, if somebody were to punch you, lights up. And so I think it's very physical, it's very emotional, and it really does tie into this need to belong. And if people don't like what we're doing or they give us negative feedback, maybe they don't like us and we're about to just be kicked out and by ourselves. It's scary.
It is scary. And Christine, kind of getting voted off the island, right?
Yeah. And I think one important aspect of this is that people are wired very differently. Like, we know that from neuroscience research. And so it's important because some people feel things much more deeply, like over 3,000 times. And so, you know, some people are wired to be much more sensitive to things like threat or embarrassment or shame and even stress. And so I think, you know, even within our families, I'm one of four and we're very different that way. Some of us are much more sensitive. Others, you couldn't possibly shake them, regardless of the kind of negative feedback or stress you threw at them. And so it's one of these things where whether you're a leader or a parent, a coach on a team, getting to know your personnel it really matters, and you can adapt accordingly or coach them to adapt to, you know, your leadership style.
Andrea, in preparation for the show, I all of a sudden remembered an eighth grade teacher, Miss Morton, who was really cruel, and in particular kind of cruel to me, and very critical. And it's funny. I mean, this is like decades ago, and yet I can relive the kind of shame I felt in her classroom, and even the kind of body response that you mentioned. I can feel that.
Yes. Yes. It sticks with us, doesn't it? And it's interesting because there are certain things that make us able to brush off stuff a little bit more easily. Like, well, you know, that person's opinion doesn't really matter to me as much, or this is about something that I already don't care about. You know, I know I'm a bad basketball player. Who cares? But yes, those times when it comes from somebody like a coach or a teacher, and of course, a parent is a whole nother realm, it sticks with us. And honestly, when I work with clients in therapy, I hear that a lot. There was this one incident, you know, when I was in elementary school, for instance, that has stuck with me forevermore.
It just, and the feeling, the emotional and the physical feeling. Christine, let me go back to you. And we're talking about how difficult criticism is, but how, I do want to talk about how important it is for us to get negative feedback that we don't necessarily want to hear, but is necessary for our functioning in the world. Why is it so important?
It's important because it guides our behavior. And so if we're not getting feedback on what we're doing correctly, or perhaps not so correctly, then we're going to be far less likely to adapt. And so really it stunts us and our growth. And, you know, it can leave us languishing. It could leave us, but really what we're doing is we're underperforming. We're not contributing our best because we don't know what we're doing and how it's landing. And so it's so important to increase people's self-awareness about what they're doing. And that's a, you know, 80% of people lack self-awareness. Tasha Yurick has studied that. And so that what that really means is we're missing the mark, the majority of our actions every day. And so we need others to kind of point us in the right direction. And she refers to it as loving critics. And I love that saying. And, you know, teams that I work with, like UNC women's soccer team, they've really embraced this. And so it's about, you know, compassionate candor, if you will. And how do you raise people up by, you know, sometimes it's telling people what they're not doing so well, or holding people accountable for, you know, living the core values in their case. So it's not easy, but it's necessary to really unlock people's potential and perform at their best.
And Andrea, I wonder how important that relationship is, or even the trust that's part of the relationship between the giver of the feedback and the receiver of the feedback.
Yes, building trust is so important because it allows us to be vulnerable enough to actually show up and listen to what the feedback is. And I love that idea of the loving critic, because it speaks to this notion too of radical kindness, right? I think so many times we think that being kind is not speaking up or not actually giving critical feedback, when in reality we can be kind and also give critical feedback. And sometimes it is better, it is more kind to give feedback than to just be polite and say nothing and let our resentment build. So I love this idea that we can show up for someone by being honest with them in a kind way rather than refusing to give any criticism whatsoever.
Christine, in preparation for the show, I ran across this phrase. I think it came from you, ruinous empathy. What is ruinous empathy?
I'd love to take credit for that one. Unfortunately, I cannot. Okay. But my friend Kim Scott is the one that has written a wonderful book, Radical Candor. And she talks about even compassionate candor these days. And ruinous empathy is this idea of holding back when we could tell someone, maybe it's the hard truth, but give constructive criticism. But we're uncomfortable with that. And it stems from this idea of empathy. Like, we want to be nice, but in being nice, we are not helping the person develop that full potential. So, you know, it's awkward maybe to tell even a boss, for example, the negative effect that they're having on the crew when, you know, they demean someone because of performance. It's maybe their tone or something, but we're not going to speak up about that. We feel awkward. A lot of times this is exacerbated by differences in culture or race or gender. You know, it adds to that awkwardness. And so we hold back, but Kim Scott talks about how 85% of the mistakes regarding giving feedback are because of this ruinous empathy. And again, it stems from a good place. People have good intentions. They don't want to hurt people, but in doing so, we're not helping people become their best.
Andrea, how do you see ruinous empathy? I mean, I almost love saying it because it just sounds so, so strong there. But as a clinical psychologist, I mean, obviously it's about avoidance. These can be tough
yes.
conversations.
Very tough conversations. And I love that concept too, because we get in our own way and we get in the way of the person that we really should be communicating with more honestly and more openly. And I think this is all exacerbated by all or none thinking, for instance. You know, I see a lot of people, well, if I tell them how I really feel or how they've been affecting me, then they're going to get upset and that means I'm a bad person, right? I mean, sometimes people will get upset by having to face the reality of a situation, but we can still be compassionate and it is anything but us being a bad person. But I think there's a lot of dichotomies in how we think of some of these interactions. If I'm kind, then it means that I don't assert myself or, you know, and again, I think there's all kinds of lenses we look through too in terms of gender, in terms of race that also affect some of these interactions. But I do love the idea of establishing that sometimes even wonderful things like compassion and empathy can go awry. They can lead us in the wrong direction at times if we take them to be these extreme one-dimensional ideas that mean that we never speak up when we do actually need to speak up.
I want to ask you, we're about a minute and a half away from our first break, Christine, about the importance of positive feedback. I mean, we're obviously going to be talking about the difficulty of criticism, but how important, especially in the workplace, and whether this is a kind of forgotten interaction, the notion of thanking people or recognizing the hard work that they're doing.
Yeah, unfortunately, it very much is. And I was shocked at the data. You know, it was above 80% of people never got even a thank you at wow. work in the last year. And, you know, this is such a simple thing. We're not talking about, you know, resources necessarily. And it matters so much to people. My friend Doug Conant was kind of famous for turning around Campbell's Soup Company years ago. And he did it in part, but with, you know, tenderhearted, like caring about people. He was tough on standards, but he wrote 30,000 thank you notes. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing because it stuck with people. You know, I've heard stories, friend ran into someone on the airplane who was bragging about the company he worked for. And 15 years ago, the CEO wrote a lowly salesperson a thank you note. And so these things really matter. They stick. People hang them up. And, you know, anywhere in the world, when leaders would visit these plants and stuff, they would see these little thank you notes hanging up because they matter. And it's a little example, but I think it shows the power that thank yous and recognition and appreciation has for us. And unfortunately, there's, you know, so little of it.
Well,
nowadays
we are talking about giving and taking criticism and thank you notes. That's Christine Porath. Also with us, Andrea Bonnier. We'll be right back after this very short break.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're talking about the give and take of criticism, how to give honest negative feedback that is actually constructive, how to make use of feedback that's hard to hear without being defensive. And again, our guests are Christine Porath. She's a professor of organizational behavior at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, wrote a book titled Mastering Community, The Surprising Ways Coming Together Moves Us from Surviving to Thriving. Andrea Bonnier is a clinical psychologist, professor at Georgetown University, and she wrote a book called Detox Your Thoughts, Quit Negative Self-Talk for Good, and Discover the Life You've Always Wanted. Christine, just a quick follow-up. You mentioned the fact that 80% of people at the workplace say no one has ever thanked them for the job that they did. Why are workplaces so withholding?
I think, unfortunately, we may just not be as attentive or mindful these days. Like, I think we are distracted, you know, whether via technology or whatever else. And I think, you know, maybe we've just gotten out of our habits. I mean, you know, one story that stuck with me was Tony Schwartz, a co-author of mine, was working with a top hospital. And he went to the nurses who were, as you can imagine, very burned out and stretched and so forth. And he asked for their biggest complaint. And it was, he was surprised. It was a lack of appreciation from the surgeons and physicians around how they work so hard to support patients. And then he went to the surgeons and he thought, you know, what was going to be their biggest complaint? And he was shocked because they said lack of appreciation from administration. Wow. And in fact, one surgeon described how he felt like a lot of times he was working in a factory where, you know, he was just, that was what he was supposed to do and never got any sense of recognition or appreciation from administration. So it's, it, you know, we think of this as maybe like lower status employees or people, you know, role players, they feel less than, but I think, you know, to our conversation earlier, it really, a lot of times, this is a much more pervasive issue. And even the people that, you know, we could thank them for going out of their way. And I know it's made me really mindful with healthcare, just thinking about, you know, they're coping with so much. And these things do matter. And that's true across industries.
Well, I wonder, Andrea, whether you're a clinical psychologist, you deal with individuals, couples probably, maybe families. I mean, how much is this an issue within that kind of relationship that people are not thankful enough to the person that they're living with?
Yes, for sure. In fact, that was the first thing that came to my mind, that this might as well be talking about couples and families. And it's remarkable how often a lack of just a simple thank you or an expression of gratitude just kind of gets to be the habit among a family, among a couple. It feels superfluous. Some people I work with say, well, it feels silly to say thank you. And I think what's so striking is that we have the research. We have immense amounts of research that expressions of gratitude are helpful not just for the receiver, but for the giver as well. And so it's pretty striking how often just building in a little bit of a better habit about telling your partner a simple thanks for something even that's kind of boring or day to day. I mean, you don't want to do it to the point where it feels empty or right. It feels like you're just going through the motions. But to truly be seen for what you do in terms of, yeah, they noticed, right? And that's part of what gratitude does. Hey, they noticed that I was the one that does this repetitive task that's kind of thankless and boring, or they actually value me. It goes a long way. I think especially when there so frequently are real conflicts around who's doing more or sort of the mental load of raising a family, for instance, I see that all the time. It's like, if, you know, I'm happy to do this, but my partner never seems to see it. And if they just saw it and said, thank you, I would feel so much better. Yeah. So yeah, it's so interesting. It's kind of like there's the organizational professional world, and it's very much mirrored a lot of times by the family unit as well.
That's fascinating. Let me stay with you, Andrea, just for a moment. But Christine, I want to hear from you as well. Thinking about delivering or giving negative feedback, oftentimes it's the tone over the content, it's the body language, it's the facial expression
yes.
that has the most power. How can we be aware of what we're doing when we're having this kind of interaction?
Yeah, well, it's pretty startling, I think, when people actually have the opportunity to see themselves in some of these interactions, whether it be, you know, they happen to have had a recorded meeting and now I look back and see that, or whether I actually go back and read. Can you imagine? Or I go back and I read the email that I sent, or somebody else happened to be recording me, or I actually looked in a mirror at my face when I deliver this. I think we have to be motivated to recognize that we are often unreliable in terms of what we believe about how we come across. And I think what's really, really problematic is that sometimes the feedback isn't even happening in person. And so what you have isn't just a negative tone. You have sort of the absence of tone. Oh, I texted it. And so the other person on the receiving end is free to fill in their own imagination about whether it was in an angry tone. Oh, they used a period rather than, you know, an exclamation point, so they seem mad, or they used all caps, even though that's sometimes just their style, but that seems like shouting, or they were really abrupt and usually they say more, so therefore they're really angry. I think a lot gets lost in the translation, or a lot gets assumed, but that's the world right now. This is often where we communicate. Oh, we texted it. We did this. And so it's really a minefield. And you're absolutely right that the tone is often what we first notice, even more so than the message itself. Like, there's research that people decide that they like a speaker, the person who's speaking, you know, within, I don't know, a minute or something before the person's ever actually said something, because we are so attuned to body language, to tone of voice, to warmth, to the way their facial expressions come across. And, you know, that's probably evolutionary as well. We needed to be able to make quick judgments about whether somebody was a friend or an enemy.
Christine, taking all of what you and Andrea then have been talking about, so what does good criticism then sound like? And good by meaning helpful, something that would help someone do a better job or have a better relationship with their coworkers. I mean, what does that look like when it's working?
Well, big thing is explain why you're giving this feedback. So ideally, you've set the tone. I think, you know, I study respect, and the big thing is if you plant those seeds of I care, then it really reduces people's defensiveness when you deliver some criticism. But starting with your intention can really lower defenses. And researchers actually have found that feedback 40% can be 40% more effective by prefacing it with just 19 words, which is, I'm giving you these comments because I have very high expectations and I know that you can reach them. And, you know, psychiatrist Edward Hallowell has found something similar to use with children, which is, I'm asking more of you because I know you have it in you. And I think that that carries over whether you're a coach or a leader or what have you. And I think the important point here is that you want to challenge, but not in a punishing way. And so, you know, again, you would adapt this depending on the person that you were coaching. But it's really important that you, you know, kind of connect with people. And I love the idea that trust was brought up so early on, because, you know, Anson Dorrance, for example, at UNC, who's won 22 national championships, he talks about how he can't coach people until he builds that trust. Like, his players have to trust him before he can get anywhere. And that's why things like doing a book club in preseason where the books are not about sports and, you know, literally building up relationships and connections matters so much. And I think whether it's workplace, teams, family, friends, what have you, that's really, really important to growing the relationship, so that when you do deliver the feedback, it's not, you know, it doesn't throw people off their game so much. It's taken with the idea of, like, you're helping me reach my goals together. And in his case, he really is their ally in where do you want to go and how can I help you?
Andrea, I'm thinking, though, for couples, and as a clinical psychologist, there's so much at stake. I mean, when it comes to living with someone, obviously, but also criticizing them or giving them some kind of negative feedback. I mean, it could be about the laundry, but it could also be about something really significant about the relationship, like you don't listen to me, or, you know, you put me down in front of our friends. I mean, things that really matter.
Right. And that's why it feels so scary to give it and most definitely to receive it. And that's why I think oftentimes a first step is making sure that you're not letting something build to the point where now when you bring it up, it is basically something that clearly has been bothering you for months, that you have a lot of resentment about, that represents a fundamental conflict within your relationship. You know, it's so much better to be able to be proactive. Couples, of course, have a hard time with this because the conversation is often uncomfortable, even if it's just bringing it up in the initial stages. But I think what at times really leads to an explosive situation among couples is that by the time they bring something up, it's obvious that it's a huge deal. And maybe it wouldn't have been a huge deal months before. It would have no longer felt so personal, so tremendously, you know, resentment inducing. So it's so much better to be proactive and to build a practice as a couple of getting used to giving feedback that doesn't feel as threatening because you're just bringing it up as it's sort of starting to bother you.
We are talking about giving and getting feedback, particularly criticism, negative feedback. And again, that's Andrea Bonnier and Christine Porath. Christine, I ran across this phrase as I was doing my homework for the show, and apparently it's not a particularly effective thing, but it's called a feedback sandwich. What is wrong with that?
Well, it's the comfortable thing to do, which is you start the conversation by, you know, kind of throwing someone a compliment and some positive feedback. And then because we feel so awkward, we kind of slip what we really have been wanting to say that would, you know, the negative part of what you want changed. And then again, because we are feeling so often so anxious about this or bad about this, we toggle back to here's another compliment and we end things. And unfortunately, what happens is that you as the giver may feel slightly less awkward doing that. However, the receiver, what they walk away with is the first thing that you said and the last thing that you said. And that's what sticks. And, you know, typically that negative important part, the meat of the sandwich, so to speak, gets lost in that. And so that's a real issue as far as what we, you know, want people to hold on to. So we hear the praise and begin to brace ourselves also, such that we fail to appreciate, you know, the positive. So, you know, we want to think about how we're doing this and, you know, whether it's, you know, writing down notes or thinking about this, rehearsing, so forth, but getting out of that habit of the feedback sandwich.
Going back to you, Andrea, I'm thinking about the person on the receiving end of this conversation. It is so easy to feel defensive or even hostility if someone is telling you something, again, critical that you do not want to hear. How do you suggest people receive this info?
Yeah, and, you know, I just have to laugh about the feedback sandwich as well, because okay. One thing that I've discovered is that sometimes people sort of see it coming. It's like, uh-oh, there's an email from my boss. And in the beginning, they're saying how well I did this small, tiny little thing. But I bet what's coming is that they hated the way I screwed up this other big project, you know. But yeah, to be on the receiving end, I think the first thing is to notice what your patterns typically are. Maybe you have certain vulnerabilities where you get really anxious with authority. And so you've got to prepare yourself that you're going to have all kinds of negative thoughts when your boss is going to be giving you your evaluation, for instance. And, you know, a lot of my work with what I do with the types of therapy I do, acceptance and commitment therapy, for instance, is learning to recognize your thoughts as being unreliable narrators at times. So being able to say, I am going to hear this voice from my boss in a distorted way. I know that about myself. I have problems with authority, or I have problems with rejection. So let me label that. Let me get used to what my patterns are so I can notice them. I know my body's going to tense up and my wrists and fingers are going to get really clenched and my heart's going to go fast. So let me establish some tools to bring that down. I mean, much as Christine had said at the beginning of the program, how we're all different. And some of us really, really have problems with feedback even more so than other people. It's so true. And in fact, there are folks out there that have something called rejection sensitivity or rejection sensitive dysphoria. And for them, they've got to be prepared for the fact that negative feedback is going to throw them for a loop. And so they've got to have those tools in advance to be able to say, okay, I'm hearing this in a distorted way, but I can manage it.
Well, I want to hear from both of you, Andrea and Christine, is that, and this is broadly speaking about us human beings, is that we don't really know ourselves very well. I'm hearing both of you say your own versions of that analysis, which I think raises a whole host of questions about why we don't know our impulses, our desires, all those sort of inner emotions as well as we could. What do you think about that, Christine?
I think it's so true. And it goes back to that self-awareness research where, you know, 95% of people think they have a great sense of self-awareness. They know their strengths and weaknesses, for example. And yet, Tasha Yurick has found that only 10 to 15% of people do. Right. And so you can imagine that huge gap, and every day we're operating on that. So I think one of the biggest challenges and something, you know, straightforward to do is just to solicit more feedback. I mean, one top technology executive shared with me that their highest rated leaders had something in common, and that was they all spiked on the item, my manager regularly solicits feedback. Huh. And that's a simple thing, whether you're asking, you know, someone for feedback over coffee or lunch, but like proactively doing that. And Tasha also has shared this great example where it's a dinner of truth, basically, and that obviously could carry over to any kind of conversation, but you're asking someone, you know, for coffee, and you're asking, you know, what do I do that's most frustrating or annoying to you? And that's hard. And you can get it started by, you know, sharing some negative feedback you've heard in the past, but it's incredibly illuminating. And when she and students and teammates have done this, it really helps get the ball rolling to kind of develop that courage, given how we've been sharing how challenging this is for most people. But that's a wonderful exercise if you really want to tackle some of the how do I get feedback.
Well, about a minute before our second break here, Andrea, but is therapy sort of a dinner of truth? I mean, is that what therapy is in a way?
Yes, yes. And I think as we get busier and busier and busier as a culture and more distracted and more splintered, I feel like we do get away from the quiet reflection that it sometimes takes to develop insights into ourselves. You know, we're kind of, I think that's adding to our lack of self-awareness because we're just doing stuff all the time. And so I think therapy can be a really important forum for that, to take that pause, to work with someone who can help you gain the insights, and you can put stuff on the table and look at it in a new way. I think that's most definitely, obviously I'm biased as a psychologist, I think it can be a useful tool for that, for sure.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about giving and receiving criticism, negative feedback, even thank you notes, talking with Andrea Bonnier. And again, she's a clinical psychologist, also a professor at Georgetown University, wrote a book titled Detox Your Thoughts, Quit Negative Self-Talk for Good, and Discover the Life You've Always Wanted. And we will be talking about that critic that lives in our head after this break. Christine Porath, professor of organizational behavior at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill. And her book is titled Mastering Community, The Surprise Ways Coming Together Moves Us from Surviving to Thriving. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskow-Wayne. We're talking about criticism, the fact that criticism sticks. It can be hard to forget. Maybe it's an unwanted, or maybe it's mean, or maybe it's actually constructive and helpful and fuels us to make a change. And again, talking with our guests, Christine Porath and Andrea Bonnier. Christine, let me just toss something at you before we start talking about the critic that lives in our head. But I'm thinking about the difference between advice and feedback. And I was reading that advice is about the future and feedback is about the past. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think that's a very apt description. I've been relying on this idea of coaching quite a bit, and they talk about leadership as coaching, and whether that's to parents or, I mean, the parents are coaches as well as, right. You know, workplace leaders and so forth. And I love that idea because if you think of yourself as a coach, it's about how do you help someone improve? And I just think that's like a beautiful spirit to have. And so I think it helps people, it reduces the anxiety. If I know very clearly my intention is to help that person, then maybe I'm less likely to have that ruinous empathy. You know, maybe I'm more courageous. And so I don't know if it's helpful to others, but if you think about yourself as a coach, that has worked really well for people that I've worked with in all spheres of life, really.
Andrea, going from coach to the critic that lives in our head, and I guess I'm speaking for all people, I'm certainly speaking for myself, that there is that voice. And I want to ask you, when we hear that negative self-talk, who is that person who's talking to us?
Oh, it's fascinating who it can be, right? For some folks, it's an amalgamation of parents, of teachers, of siblings, of the first person that rejected them romantically, right? And what's so interesting is that the more that you can actually give that voice some form, you know, what does it sound like? Does it speak in a high pitch? You know, it sounds silly to say, let's give this voice in our heads a form. But the more you can actually engage in what we call self-distancing, which is to be able to say, this is a voice that I'm hearing, but it's not me. It's not necessarily accurate. It's not necessarily valid. It is an unreliable narrator. It is maybe a heckler in our mental audience. And it actually, you can have some fun with this. I have clients who, you know, have a certain negative self-talk voice, and we turn it into that classic sort of school marmy, you know, oh, you'll never get a job. You're just a disaster since you failed that chemistry test. And, you know, it sounds silly, but what it allows them to do is to start engaging in this self-distancing, where they're better able to actually recognize the distortion in this voice, that it's not really telling me the truth right here. Or if it is telling me a kernel of truth, I don't have to keep hearing it. I can decide how to act on that kernel of truth, and I can move forward. Because what's really fascinating about the research behind anxious rumination is that we're really learning that it's not that negative thoughts per se turn into anxiety and depression. It's negative thoughts becoming sticky that turn into anxiety and depression. And that's why mindfulness techniques can be helpful, because it allows us to sort of get that detachment where the thoughts no longer stick in the same way. We can more easily move on from them. Oh, that's my, you know, that's my school marm. She's been with me for a long time. And I can say, all right, I hear what you're saying, but I've got other things to do, right?
Absolutely. But what you're also telling us, Andrea, is that we talk to ourselves all the time, right? I mean, we have these running conversations with ourselves, and mostly unconscious. But every now and then, you know, Miss Morton appears.
Exactly. And to make ourselves aware of it is really an important first step to then be able to not be as affected by it as much.
Christine, you want to weigh on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think one important thing that I learned was the people that are best, what they labeled self-awareness unicorns, ask what and not why. Mm-hmm. Why is that rumination that Andrea was just talking about, where, you know, we can start spinning or spiraling downward if you're like a lot of people. But if you focus on like, what can I do? You know, if you have a disagreement with your significant other, you might ask like, what do I want out of this relationship? Or what do I need to do in the future to make sure this doesn't happen? What am I going to do next time the same issue presents itself? What helps stay objective, future focused, and empowered to act on our new insight, that feedback or coaching we received? Whereas why leads us on a totally different and usually self-destructive, or at least spinning, you know, aspect where we're not moving forward.
Whereas the other one sort of solves a problem, right?
Exactly. Yes. So the why traps us in our thoughts, I think. And so the what can bring forth that future focused, how do I control this? You know, the idea being, they call it neutral thinking, but control what you can control and think about just that next step. You know, you don't think about the last play, for example, or, you know, that negative feedback kernel that maybe led you astray. You focus on like, what can I actually do? And it may be a baby step, but literally, like, where do I go from here? And you know, try to disengage, disconnect as much as possible from, let's say, that last play.
And Andrea, I mean, we would rarely treat another person the way we might be treating ourselves in our head. We wouldn't say all the critical things to another person that we say to ourselves. Mm-hmm.
Oh, completely. I mean, I often get a laugh out of my students when I say, okay, for instance, let's talk about, you know, the classic body image thoughts that a college young woman has, right?
Yes.
College age young woman. I say, okay, that voice that's talking to you as you, you know, take your ninth pose for Instagram and still don't like the way you look in this outfit, or when you're trying on swimsuits, imagine if you said that out loud to your best friend. And, you know, they'll laugh and be like, well, that'd be terrible. And you see this happen all the time, I think, especially with certain areas of sensitivity that are, you know, really broad across the culture, body image, how we look, all of these things. You see, you know, friends getting together and it's like, oh, well, you know, I am such a slob, but you are, you know, great. How do you do this? And I think it's really a helpful tool at times to say, if I were to say this out loud to somebody that I loved, would it be hurtful to them? And if the answer is yes, let's think about why it's so acceptable to so pervasively let that be the voice that we use when we talk to ourselves.
You use the word rumination, and I mean, just making sure our listeners know. And that's, Andrea, just kind of an obsessive going over of maybe an incident that happened that you feel badly about or wish didn't happen, something like that?
Exactly. Yeah, rumination is really kind of that sticky, persistent, obsessive type of thought. I have a client who calls it getting wrapped around the axle. It's so apt, because it's this idea that you're not making progress. It's repeating itself, and it's sticky, and just, it's this dark kind of cloud that you're just stuck inside. And I think, you know, one thing that's important for people to recognize is that, yeah, a lot of critical feedback is important for us to listen to. So it's not that we should ignore it, just as we spoke about, you know, all hour, but we need to be able to move forward with it. Just like Christine had said, how can I act according to my values here, make something of this critical feedback, and not just keep spinning and spinning and spinning about how negative it feels? How can I actually move ahead and strategize to make things better, given the fact that I had this feedback?
And why does that happen at 3 a.m? Right?
Yes, that's a universally universally hated time, and very classic for rumination. Yeah, I mean, I do think life feels more threatening in the dark, right? And then you have the rumination of, oh my goodness, I need to be sleeping, and now I'm going to be...
Exactly.
So it builds on itself.
Christine, let me go back to you, and even going back to the workplace, it has changed so much really since the pandemic. We've got not everybody, obviously, but more people that are working more remotely. And if we're talking about feedback and helping people with their careers, hopefully on the, you know, on the positive side of feedback, is that a bigger challenge these days because we're just not together the way we used to be?
I do think it is a bigger challenge. I think we just need to be much more mindful to schedule these things, you know, where they used to talk about the water cooler, you know, running into each other in the elevator and the little, you know, office room that we would go to share lunch. And that's obviously not happening for the vast majority of people. So putting it on the books or, you know, scheduling coffee time or happy hour or whatever the case may be, even virtually is very helpful. I mean, some of the research that shows like how people eat together, it's amazing the information that gets shared there. You know, there was a firefighter study where a fireman shared that he was scared of heights. And wow. That, you know, manager then scheduled things differently on the fire that they went to, you know, fight right after that. But like, he would have never guessed he had a firefighter that was scared of heights, you know, sitting amongst them. But I mean, that's the kind of thing that when we share space and eating together is a wonderful way to do this, it really breaks down barriers. And it comes back to the idea of just connecting on a human level. And building that trust and building that connection, or, you know, my case, I study community, and it's so lacking, you know. So 65% of people, this was pre-pandemic, across over 20,000 people, did not feel any sense of community at work.
Wow.
And that's dropped 37% since the pandemic that we found. So it's really, really challenging to create that connection such that you remove these barriers, you know, get people to become less defensive, you know, feeling the feedback, but maybe more importantly, where we started this was build up the courage and the connection to feel like I can give the feedback, I can make a difference. You know, the person, we have that connection that can, you know, survive that maybe jarring or challenging feedback that's delivered.
Well, the show is called The Connection, so, you know, it's kind of right in our wheelhouse here. But, Andrea, I'd love to have you weigh in on that. The fact that, you know, we're living in a different world than we were 4 or 5 years ago, at least when it comes to person-to-person interactions.
Yes, I think it's impossible to overestimate the impact that that has had. And I think it should be more of a concern than is being talked about, because it really is something that is fundamental to human health, right? I mean, there's so much research that says that social connection is as crucial to our physical health as certain other health habits. I know there's the famous study where loneliness was the mortality equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes per day when it came to longevity, right? So I think what's tough is that we do need to be so much more proactive about it in recognizing what is quality connection versus what is just the sort of automatic scratching the itch online, clicking a like on something. We have to be more proactive now because we don't see our coworkers every day in person, most likely if we have the certain type of job where telework is possible, where we don't naturally interact with our neighbors in a way that we might have in a past generation. So I think we do need to be more proactive and really give ourselves permission to prioritize it as an actual health issue.
And Christine, I began by talking about, you know, the fact that we're asked all the time now to give feedback on some kind of experience that we've had, and it's generally anonymous. And I think when things are anonymous or when people can be anonymous, it's easier to kind of pile on and be negative. What do you think about that?
I wish that weren't the case. But yeah, you hear about trolling, and I think social media, we see a lot of evidence of that. But, you know, in our incivility research, we just find that it's so easy when you're anonymous to, like you said, pile on to people. You know, we don't see the face, or, you know, going back to the nonverbals, how we're hurting someone, even visually. We don't get it because we don't hear the tone of how they feel about this. And it's really, we've become dehumanized, I think, to how our behavior affects other people. And we're living in an age where that is easier, more accessible to kind of lob from afar to, you know, maybe get out some of our frustrations. I mean, I think the other piece of this is that people are feeling more negative and, you know, are hurting, are more isolated and so forth than ever before. And that's bringing a lot of negativity into our interactions, particularly when they are anonymous. And so I think it's just exacerbating the issue that you mentioned, which is people are feeling like they're hurt or disconnected or isolated. You know, they're feeling harmed more than ever before. And that, unfortunately, what we know is that that's contagious. So we spread that. And again, it's not bad intentions. It's just we're not feeling as good. And so the next person that we run into, the person that's checking us out at the grocery store or, you know, what have you, they get that from us. And so it spreads in really negative ways that are not good for relationships or society.
I'm watching the clock here. Andrew, I'm going to give you the last question, which is how do we then, if kind of coming full circle, talking about criticism, how can we then see our mistakes, our failures as some kind of opportunity to learn, to grow?
Yeah, I think it goes along with this more holistic way of looking at our lives, right? Not expecting things to always be perfect or easy, giving ourselves self-compassion so we can say, I'm going to screw up. And yet I'm going to learn from it. I think right now our culture is very fixated on, you know, achieve, don't ever fail. We see that as a problem when in child rearing, right? A lot of kids are being terrified of failing at anything. And we see that in the anxiety and depression that they end up having, right? So I recommend this idea of being able to take a step back and say, there can be so much meaning, even in discomfort, that there can be so much growth even when it's not easy, even when I hear something that is really hard for me to take in, I can take it in. I can be able to learn something from it. And I think the more that we can take that mindset of insight rather than perfection, then we can grow further and further.
Well, I really appreciate both of you joining us today on The Connection. Andrea Bonnier, thank you so much.
Thank you.
She's a clinical psychologist, wrote a book called Detox Your Thoughts. Christine Pora, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And she's a professor of organizational behavior at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, wrote a book called Mastering Community. Well, thank you for joining us on The Connection. It airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram, find us on Facebook, and check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection for info about upcoming shows and to sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, our engineer, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, the producers.